All right, so then I have, so as long as he had his out, I better have mine. He's going to sweat. I think you've got it already. And you over here. And what you're doing. All right, so we are going to cover mainly today the ongoing genesis of methods and natural right and historical mindedness. So my intent is that we would touch only briefly on the human good, which was another one that I listed for today. The main reason that I don't intend to go into detail on the paper, The Human Good, is that there's very little new in it beyond the chapter on the human good in Method of Theology. And the focus of this course is Lonergan's development after Method of Theology. And there's not much in the paper, The Human Good, that would manifest that, whereas there's quite a bit in both of the others, the ongoing genesis of methods and natural right and historical mindedness. I'm not intent on finishing the discussion today of the both of those papers. And as you probably have noticed, I've slowed down the number of papers that we're going to be covering for the rest of the course. So if we go over, I think it's almost certain that we will go over into next week on natural right and historical mindedness. It's such a crucial thing. You know, it sums up so much of Lonergan's thought in 20 pages that it's like a testament of the meaning of all of his work in many ways. These notes, you'll notice, I noticed that some of you have noticed it already, the last couple of pages are simply photocopied from my book, What is Systematic Theology, where I did a summary of a portion of natural right and historical mindedness, and it was the same thing that I was going to type out, and so I figured, why type it out when it's already done? So if I'm plagiarizing there, I'm plagiarizing from myself. All right, so the paper, first of all, then, The Ongoing Genesis of Methods, is the third in the series that Jeff introduced us to last week, the first two being Religious Experience and Religious Knowledge. The previous lecture, Religious Knowledge, ended with the suggestion, which I think Jeff presented very deftly last week, that inner conviction is the conviction that the norms of attentiveness, intelligence, reasonableness, responsibility have been satisfied. That's what leaves a person with a peaceful conscience, is that conviction that those norms have been satisfied. And satisfying those norms is the high road to objectivity to be attained in the world mediated by meaning and motivated by values. There is no easy route to objectivity because it's not a matter of simply taking a good look at what's already out there. It's a matter of raising all of the pertinent questions about each issue and answering them as thoroughly as we can. So the present lecture, The Ongoing Genesis of Methods, begins with the question, does such religious conviction have to be regarded as at best a private affair? So in both of these papers that were discussing today, Ongoing Genesis of Methods and Natural Right and Historical Mindedness, we're moving to the social and to what in Natural Right he calls collective responsibility. So does inner conviction, does the conviction that comes from the firm belief that one has satisfied the norms of attentiveness, intelligence, reasonableness, responsibility, is that simply private? Or can it be social? Can it be public? Can you have a communal authenticity? Can you have a communal attentiveness, intelligence, reasonableness, responsibility? Can it be built somehow into the social order? Can it be recognized in the social order and the cultural order? In the notes on natural right and historical mindedness, I'll talk about this as a transposition of Hegel's objective spirit into Lonergan's realism. The social order is an objectification of the common orientation of the community, and in that sense, he's getting at the kind of thing that Hegel wanted to get at, but not in the sense of an absolute idealism of this spirit that is moving through history, but more in the sense of that what results in the makeup of any cultural order is the embodiment of the attentiveness, intelligence, reasonableness, responsibility, and or inattentiveness, stupidity, silliness, and irresponsibility of the body politic, of the social community. So this is the kind of thing that he's trying to get at in these papers. It will come up again in Natural Right under the heading of collective responsibility. Is there such a thing, or can we only talk about individual responsibility? So here it's whether or not religious conviction has to be just a private affair, and then what are the conditions under which the study of religion and or theology might become an academic subject? That's a distinct issue. And how are these two related to each other, religious studies and theology? So it's a number of things that he's raising in this. First, then, the origins of this dynamic of, well, let me, I guess I better do the final sentence in number one there. The ongoing genesis of methods, that phrase, not just the title, but the phrase to talk about the ongoing genesis of methods, explains both the disarray of contemporary theologies and a significant set of stirrings in religious studies. So there are ferments at the level of method that are going on in these areas, and so to come at it from the standpoint of method is can throw some light on these things.
And now we go.
All right. So, number two, then, the origin of this dynamic of methods that we find in the contemporary scene all over the place is found in the origins are found in the scientific revolution in the 16th and 17th centuries. And we saw enough of that in the other paper, so I don't want to go into it in detail, but there's something more that I should have put in the notes here so that the connections in the lecture can be clear. What has resulted from that scientific revolution is, first of all, the awareness that science is not an individual affair. Science is social. Any science in its entirety at the present time exists not in the mind of any one individual, but only in the entire community of people devoted to that scientist, to that science. No chemist knows the whole of chemistry. Even the limited amount that chemistry has achieved up to this point, it's not in the mind of any one person. It's too much for any one mind. It's in the community. And the same thing is true with theology. No theologian knows everything in the eight functional specialties. It's the entire community of people engaged in those eight functional specialties that know what theology today is. It's not the possession of an individual. And the same would be true even with systematic theology. It's a communal enterprise. That's just one functional specialty. There's no one of us doing that that can be on top of all of the issues. And I don't think that it would be very, very difficult to write a full systematic theology if just an individual. You go as far as you can. My hope is to do something in this area. Just do one track. Because you'll get it, right? Okay. What resulted in the contemporary scene out of the scientific revolution is also the recognition of the fact that scientific knowledge does not know necessity. It's subject to revision. It knows possibilities, the best possibilities, the verifiable possibilities, the best opinion of the time. And so now we can come to the reason for the statement in number three. It raises a problem of foundations and relativism. And that's the second topic of the paper and one that I want to go into in more detail. So the dynamic of methods that arose in the scientific revolution, because its upshot is that no one knows the full science in any science, and that what science knows is not what has to be, but only what might be, and what has been verified up to the present time in the sense that it hasn't been falsified. So it's still a possibility, but nothing more than that, and it's subject to revision. Method can revise the principles and laws on which a successful science has been constructed. So the question arises, if that can happen, can methods themselves be open to correction and revision? And if methods themselves can be revised, then is the whole of science just a vast structure resting upon sand? There's one person, his name escapes me right now, and I should have thought of it as I was preparing the notes. Feyerabend, is that it? F-E-Y-E-R-A-B-E-N-D. Feyerabend is pretty much saying this, that, science may have some consequences that achieve things like, this, that, and the other thing, but ultimately what it knows is constructive. It's a construction that may or may not have any validity whatsoever. So Lonergan's response to that question is rather that all such changes in science, all such modifications in science, do come under a higher or more general law, and that is the law that he will call generalized empirical method. The revisions of existing theories and the developments of existing methods are just fresh instances of attending to the data, grasping their intelligibility, formulating the content of the new insights, checking as thoroughly as possible their validity. In other words, being attentive, intelligent, reasonable, responsible. So underpinning the special methods, there is this thing that he has called generalized empirical method, or that in method in theology itself he called transcendental method. Which, as I think I mentioned last time, he preferred to go back to his earlier term, generalized empirical method, because the other was making him sound too Kantian and also not distinguishing him from others with whom he has something in common, but not completely, the people that are referred to as transcendental Thomists. So he prefers to use the generalized empirical method. But notice the radicalism of the statement here. For him, this is the only thing that gets us beyond relativism. And the same thing will be true in terms of culture and cultural values and so on. No culture is normative for genuine humanity. What is normative and what alone is normative is be attentive, be intelligent, be reasonable, be responsible, and by God's grace, be in love. That's the response to relativism and nothing else. So, then somebody will say, well, that's just an appeal to individual subjectivity. You're back in the Cartesian and Kantian stuff. That's not a secure foundation. So what's his response to that? Well, if by individual subjectivity you mean the subject in the world of immediacy, like the infant taking a good look and not knowing anything else, well, then, of course, there's not much of a foundation. That's not a secure foundation, and that would give rise to serious doubts and well-founded uneasiness. But I'm not appealing to the individual subjectivity that is correlative to the world of immediacy. I'm appealing first and foremost to the individual subjectivity that is correlative to the world mediated by meaning and motivated by value. So I'm appealing to the subject who raises questions for intelligence and won't stop raising them until he or she is satisfied, and then goes on to raise questions for reflection, is that true, and won't stop raising those questions until one has grasped the virtually unconditioned, and then, in certain instances at least, goes on to ask the further question, what am I going to do about it, and doesn't stop asking the question until one reaches some kind of self-transcendent response, moral response in action. That's what I'm talking about, not the individual subject in the world of immediacy. I'm talking about the individual subjectivity that is the source and the only source of genuine objectivity. The experience of the subject correlative to the world of immediacy is a purely private affair. And we all have to get beyond the immediate responses sometimes that we have, which are our private responses to things, and ask questions about, well, is that really an intelligent and reasonable and responsible way to proceed? We all live still partly in the world of immediacy. And the world of immediacy can tell us an awful lot about things. For instance, we pick up in the world of immediacy such things as body language and that sort of thing, and we have a response to it. That's all in the world of immediacy. But, part of the meaning of meditation is to get all that stuff filtered right? So that we don't respond in the purely stimulus response kind of way to things. So attention, intelligence, reasonableness, responsibility take individuals out of the isolation and privacy of the experiential infrastructure. But that's anything but foolproof. We attain authenticity only by unfailing fidelity to the exigencies of intelligence, reasonableness, and conscience. And the shortcomings of individuals, so that's, we attain it only by that. And of course, the other thing that he's emphasizing in a lot of other places, and that's always a struggle. That's always a withdrawal from unauthenticity. I thought, Jeff, you were the one who emphasized the un part of the word, unauthenticity. That was the first time I've heard that emphasis, and I think it makes sense to it. But I think you made a lot of sense there. The withdrawal, it's always a withdrawal. No one, and it's in, you know, he'll appeal to people like Teresa of Avila, who is constantly protesting how sinful she is, you know, and for the rest of us, that sounds ridiculous. But the more one grows in holiness, the more one is aware of one's own lack of righteousness, if you want. But now here's the real problem, and this is the one that he is coming to deal with more and more through these essays that we're studying today, that the shortcomings of individuals can become the accepted practice of the group, which in turn can become the tradition, accepted in good faith by succeeding generations, so that high points in culture can be, for instance, can be watered down over time, because the shortcomings of individuals start to become, you know, it's a lot easier than reaching for the stars, as it were, in what one is doing. And then this can become a tradition accepted in good faith by succeeding generations. And this can happen in the scientific community. It can happen in theology. It can happen in religious communities. He's got this expression that he uses sometimes about religious orders. You know, the rules are still read out, but one wonders if the home fires are still burning, because they may have lost their... What got them started in the first place, you know? The authentic people can become alienated from their society and culture. Average people can just go along with things as they are and not even know that they are authentically representing and spreading unauthenticity. They're doing it authentically in the sense that they don't really know that this is what it is. Isn't this great? You know, but it could really be a departure from what really is great. And the more numerous the people who concur with that decision, the less is the hope of recovery from unauthenticity, and the greater the risk of the disintegration and decay of an entire civilization. Since disintegration and decay are not private events, even generalized empirical method is experimental. And the experiment is conducted not by an individual, not by any generation, but by the historical process itself. Societies will crumble if, over a prolonged period of time, their social structures, their cultural structures, are the collective result and the cumulative result of collective inattention, stupidity, unreasonableness, and irresponsibility. It's kind of inevitable. So this is all relevant to the collective responsibility that he'll be talking about in Natural Right and Historical Mindedness, and he's groping for a language to talk about something that is beyond just the responsibility of the individual. Are we okay up to this point in terms of what he's doing? Okay, why the proliferation of methods? You know, in method and theology, well, there's methods of research, there are methods of exegesis, there's methods of history, there's dialectical method, which is something that he's introducing into theology, and then foundational method, methods for doing doctrines, for systematic communication, and that's just within theology. Then you've got these methods in physics, you've got them in science, in chemistry, you've got them in sociology, psychology, and so why the proliferation? Because of increasing specialization. Specialization means limitation, and limitation serves to define the possibility and encourage the actuality of additional distinct and even disparate methods. So section three, from method to methods. Method meaning generalized empirical method, experience, understanding, judgment, decision, to the proliferation of methods. There are differentiations of method within the basic procedures of the natural sciences. And since Lonergan's day, I think this has proceeded even further, and this is something I'm not particularly ready to comment on too much, but Patrick Helan, who was a person who's done a good deal of work in Lonergan at Georgetown University and wrote an amazing book on objectivity and quantum physics under the influence of Insight a number of years ago, is also doing a lot now on the hermeneutical dimensions of natural science itself. I find it interesting. I don't know where I stand with regard to it yet, but it's an interesting kind of thing. So he's calling attention to some things that I know that others are doing as well, but he's the one that I'm most familiar with. Then there are historical studies as they developed in Germany in the 19th century. And this was the big development for Lonergan once he went to the Gregorian in 1953, after Insight was basically written. He was basically finished writing the book in 1953. It didn't get published till 57. But he went to the Gregorian University in Rome and came into contact with these students from Germany and France who had been studying Heidegger and existentialism and phenomenology and historical method and the German historical school and all of this kind of thing. And he began to realize that there is a whole other set of methods that Insight itself didn't really have much to say about. Although he's got a bit on hermeneutics, which I think is very important in chapter 17. Still, there's a whole thing that he had to learn, and he learned it mainly through Gadamer, about what happened in Germany in the 19th century and into the 20th century through Heidegger right down to Gadamer's own work. And here what he became aware of was the profound difference between natural science and historical study. I'm coming to see more and more now that the notion of experience in Insight is based upon the fact that he was concerned mainly with natural science. And experience there is experience much more of raw data than it is in history, where the data in history and the data in human studies, the data in literature, are already informed by human acts of meaning. So there's an intelligence that has already produced these data. And in that sense, there's a difference, a relative difference at least, from the data and the natural sciences themselves. Natural science history is a recapturing of humanity's understanding of itself, recapturing it in interpretation, thematizing an understanding that first of all was lived. And it's that lived understanding that provides the very data for the science today. So the data are already informed by Verstehen, by human understanding. This is very different from at least the mainstream of thinking about the natural sciences, where the data are, you know, color, sound, touch, and so on and so forth, not words. Not language, informed by human acts of meaning. So these historical studies, the interpretative reconstruction of the constructions of the human spirit. So it's the constructions of the human spirit that provide the data, and those constructions are already informed by human acts of meaning. So this is, again, a distinct specialization and a set of distinct specializations from the natural sciences, where the data are... You know, they weren't created by a linguistic text. They're not provided by a linguistic text. They're provided by this desk and, you know, the molecules and all of that sort of thing. So, many different kinds of methods. I've got a paper on that, and it's also some stuff in What is Systematic Theology on the importance of the fact that data in the human sciences are already informed by Verstehen, by human acts of meaning. The paper is Reception and Elemental Meaning, which is in a very recent issue of the Toronto Journal of Theology. Just arguing that there is a... Well, pointing out the significance of this, of the difference between data in natural science and data in human studies, including theology. The data in theology are already, they're mostly textual, but they're also liturgical, and they're, various, but filled with symbolic and linguistic meaning. Data informed by meaning already. Okay.
So in that sense, the leap from experience to understanding is much different.
Yeah, what I think it is, I think that it's something like this, that, and this is what I say in that paper, that the first level experience in any kind of human affairs, including the conversation that we're having right now, the first level, there's already as you are receiving the sounds that I'm uttering, you're also understanding. And I can say that, I can see that because you're nodding your head when I say it. So there's an understanding that is already there. There's a Verstehen that is part of experience. It's part of your first level. But it's still not your own, because you have to ask yourself, well, you know, have I really understood what he's talking about? And then, do I agree with it or not? So, those are the steps that Lonergan's talking about, you know. But there is an understanding involved already as you receive the sounds that I'm uttering, because those sounds are, I hope, meaningful. And so you are receiving them with understanding at the experiential level. You're not just hearing sounds, receiving meaning, reception of meaning. But you still have to say, well, I don't know, you know, because you still have to exercise your original meaningfulness, you know. You're hearing my language. So my utterances are data, and those utterances are already filled with meaning, but they still have to become yours, or something has to become yours, either appropriating them or ultimately rejecting them. And that's your responsibility. Does that make sense?
I'll have to think about it, because it's...
What I say in the paper is that there are many uses of the German word Verstehen that are not exactly the same thing as what Lonergan means by one's own original insight. A lot of what is meant by the German word Verstehen is the understanding component that is involved in the reception of data themselves. There's an understanding component that's not just pure experience of sense data or data of consciousness. You're not simply experiencing sounds, but at the very level of the reception, you are understanding. And that's Verstehen. And that's the way Verstehen is used in a lot of the German literature. I think I've got that right. But insight, in the sense in which Lonergan's using it, is that those words may be providing a problem for you. And you ask questions, and then you come to your own insight, second level stuff. When you said, I'll have to think about it, you see, that's exactly what he's talking about when he's saying there's a difference between the reception of something that's got meaning in it and your own appropriation of that in your insight. So there's a difference between Verstehen and insight, in the sense in which Lonergan is most often using the word insight. Insight is your own. You've made it your own. Okay, it's what in method he calls original meaningfulness. It comes as a result of your asking your questions and coming to an answer.
And that's
so,
elemental meaning, right?
The elemental meaning is at the reception level. The meaning in, like, as you hear what I'm saying, it's still experiential. I call it a devalued formal intelligibility. That's using Lonergan's terms, but it's devalued not in the sense that it's not valuable, but it's not the formal intelligibility that emerges from you saying, I've got it, and I agree with it. Then you've got something much more, and that's much more than elemental meaning at that point. It's especially when you start to conceptualize it and you put it in your own language and so on, you're beyond elemental meaning.
Because Habermas, I think he says that we always, in a situation, we receive things interpreted by human interpretation.
That's right, and I think that's part of what I'm saying here. It's involved, that interpretation's involved in experience itself. Now, in Lonergan's understanding, in his presentation of the level of experience in insight, I think it's very much under the influence of the model of the natural sciences, where that interpretative element is at least minimal. It's minimal compared to what it is in the human sciences. You know, but even there, you know, the data that any scientist today doing physics encounters in the laboratory are already under the influence of so much physical theory, because those data have been constructed out of previous experimentation. So they're also under the influence of theoretical manipulation. They're not just pure sounds and colors and tastes and odors and all of that sort of thing. But still, the interpretative or hermeneutic element is much stronger in any kind of human affairs, human studies, literature, human sciences, philosophy, theology, law, common sense, conversation. And this is what I think a lot of, Ravi, you can correct me on this, but I think a lot, I'm not saying exclusively, but a lot of Heidegger's emphasis on Verstehen is getting at Verstehen at this level, at the level of empirical reception. He's really pointed out, he's done a great deal, it's a great contribution that he's made to cognitional theory, in my estimation, by emphasizing that.
Would it be fair, Bob, to say that at some point Lonergan does emphasize the hermeneutical element as constitutive of the generalized empirical method he's proposing?
Yeah, he definitely came to emphasize that. There's no question about that. I don't think the emphasis is strong in insight itself. It's there, and especially in the chapter 7 on common sense as object, meaning as constitutive of social arrangements and cultural mores and so on. It's definitely there. The language of meaning as constitutive is not there. Yes, that language did not come until later. And he had to encounter the European scene firsthand, and it was the students who came from Germany and France who got him. He knew these people and so on and so forth, but he knew them and he didn't know them. He didn't know how important they were and what a contribution they had to make to his project, you know, until he ran and then he encountered the richness of this whole tradition in Europe itself.
I kind of remember, doesn't he say in Insight, when early chapters there, but he speaks of insight, you know, occurring within a context, the context of insights. So when I read that, I kind of...
Yeah, it's all there in germ. I think it's there in germ, you know. And it's the same thing is true with judgments in contexts, the relation of judgments to the past, the relations among judgments in the present, the relation of judgments to the future. All of which is kind of Heidegger's time thing, too, you know. When I was writing these papers back in 3 years ago, Reception and Elemental Meaning and Empirical Consciousness in Insight, is our conception too narrow, is the name of the paper. It hasn't appeared yet. And language, Insight and Language, which has appeared in an Indian journal. Divyadan? Do you know Divyadan? While I was writing it, I was struggling to find enough in Insight to back up, to support what I was saying. And it's there, but it's not emphasized. It isn't emphasized the way it is in the later work, where constantly he's talking about the data of science, the data of natural science are, at least in the ideal instance, in the limit, not informed by human meaning. The data of human science are all informed already by human meaning, and the data of theology are informed by divine meaning. You know, if there's any meaning to the expression "the Word of God," then the meaning is not just a human construction, but it's under divine inspiration and grace. God's entrance into human meaning. So our reception of Scripture is a reception of meaning that is not only human, but also influenced by God's inspiration and grace, however we conceive of it. Good. All right. So the proliferation of methods, then. You've got the three broad categories of natural science, human science, theology. And then within those, you've got a proliferation. The fourth section, dialectic. Okay. And here he's opening on to the meaning of praxis, which we will see next week in more detail in the paper Theology and Praxis. The more human studies turn away from abstract universals and attend to concrete human beings, the more evident it becomes that the scientific age of innocence has come to an end. What does he mean by that? Well, there was a time when scientists presumed that, objectivity is not a real problem. Just pay attention to everything that's there, you know? But the problem is that there are so many things that can influence our perception of what comes into our ken in the first place, that we've got to call into question the veracity of our even our perception of data. It may very well be that we have to exercise what Paul Ricoeur calls a hermeneutic of suspicion with respect to ourselves, as well as a hermeneutic of restoration or recovery. So when human studies attempt to deal bravely and boldly with the world mediated by meaning and motivated by value, they find themselves involved in philosophic, ethical, and religious issues. And this is why ultimately Lonergan will say religious studies and theology need each other. Religious studies, if it's really dealing with the concrete, it will find itself ultimately involved in philosophic, ethical, and religious issues where differences are radical. Those radical differences become embodied in traditions, and those radical differences cannot but reflect the possibility that unauthenticity entered in at some point and remained to ferment the mass through ages to come. There was a time when it was thought that in science, human wickedness could be evaded, because it was thought that truth consisted in necessary conclusions deduced from self-evident principles, or that reality was already out there now, and objectivity was the simple matter of taking a good look, seeing all that was there and not seeing what was not there. But now, human studies have to cope with the complexity that recognizes, first, that the data may be a mixed product of authenticity and unauthenticity. All right, you're trying to do a social study of Canada, for instance. The data that you start out with are the mixed product of authenticity and unauthenticity, of intelligent, reasonable, responsible behavior and stupid, silly, irresponsible behavior. And they're mixed together. And the very investigation of the data may be affected by the personal or inherited unauthenticity of the investigators. So it gets quite complex. The dialectical process is exemplified in Ricoeur's distinction of a hermeneutic of recovery and a hermeneutic of suspicion, or again in Lonergan's study of the origins of Christian realism. If you've read The Way to Nicaea, you'll see how he's doing it. It's a very limited area in which he's doing it there. But it's the presence and absence of the movement towards intellectual conversion through the first three centuries of Christianity. It is exemplified, there should be an is there after exemplified. It is exemplified in historical issues. Progress, decline, recovery, by the concrete issues of radical disagreement among historians, where the source of the problem doesn't lie in the data, but in the investigators. He's already unfolded this in Method and Theology, that two historians can study the same data and employ the same methods and end up with radically different results. The reason is not the data, the reason is not the methods, the reason is the two historians. And their presuppositions, their starting points, their biases, their prejudices, and using that term in a neutral sense, as Gadamer insists that we have to use it, it's just that we all start out with assumptions. And that's the prevalence of those assumptions that is what dictates the final conclusions of the differences. And now, here's a very interesting thing that he's opening up here. Besides the dialectic that is concerned with human subjects as objects, there is the dialectic in which human subjects are concerned with themselves and one another, where dialectic becomes dialogue. Again, this will be the conclusion of natural right and historical mindedness. But notice what he says here, that dialogue is particularly relevant, and I think this is something that he saw after Method and Theology. I don't think it's this... I think Method and Theology is simpler, narrower on this. The possibility that people are authentic and know that they're authentic yet still belong to differing traditions and find themselves in basic disagreement. This is what we find in the Dialogue of World Religions, that people can be authentic, they can know that the other is authentic, and still they can find themselves in basic disagreement because they belong to differing traditions. And now in Method and Theology, I think that he would have said, anytime you get basic disagreements, you're into the dialectical thing where at least one of the persons involved has to undergo a religious or moral or an intellectual conversion. But here he's saying that may not be the case at all. That you could have basic disagreement even when people are religiously, morally, and intellectually converted in the transcendental sense of those terms which he has presented, because they belong to these different traditions and they find themselves in basic disagreement. So, and his examples are ecumenism within the Christian Church and the universalist movement in the Dialogue of World Religions. I may be as authentic a Christian as I can possibly be, and I may be in dialogue with a person who is as authentic a Buddhist as he or she can possibly be. We know that we are struggling for authenticity. I know that she is, and she knows that I am. And yet, on certain issues, at least, we may still find ourselves not agreeing, particularly on the significance of belief in God, for instance, or on the meaning of Jesus Christ. So... what do you do then? Well, then you do what Whitson is proposing of the coming convergence of world religions. That's the kind of thing, the possibility that opens up there. Okay, and then praxis. Can we finish this? Yes, we can. A fifth section is on praxis, where the term praxis has to do with a method. So here's a new method. A method that can deal with the unauthentic as well as the authentic, with the irrational as well as the rational. And this is partly Lonergan's contribution to the whole discussion of the ongoing genesis of methods. That in fact, by calling us back to self-appropriation of the subject, to interiority, of attentiveness, intelligence, reasonableness, responsibility, self-appropriation in as full a sense as we can possibly achieve, he has provided us with a method that can deal with the unauthentic, with the irrational, as well as with the authentic and the rational. Praxis then can become an academic subject, but only after we recognize that the age of innocence is over, that all of us engaged in theology or in human studies or philosophy or science or whatever, we are all dialectically engaged in the struggle between authenticity and unauthenticity. Praxis in this sense moves from above downwards in that its method follows from a decision. The decision, namely, to be as attentive, intelligent, reasonable, responsible as we can be. It is most relevant in the sphere of religion, and this is where he's going to bring religious studies and theology to complement one another. As lived, religion is already praxis, but praxis not yet questioned, not yet scrutinized, not yet made explicit and thematic. Theology comes out of the questioning, and the emergence is, I would say, at least threefold. He emphasizes three here. In the ancient church, the question centered on issues like Christology and Pelagianism, Christology and grace. In the medieval period, there was the effort to move from the symbolic to the literal and to the systematic. And that effort led further in the modern period under the influence of modern science, modern exegetical and historical methods, and modern philosophies. It moved further. Still, sound renewal is not yet a common achievement, and this is one of his constant emphases, I know, also in conversation after the Second Vatican Council. Just because we had a council doesn't mean we're yet renewed, you know? And it still is the case. So the contemporary situations he believed, and I don't know how he would say it today with all of the hot conflict in today, but he felt optimistic about the possibility of a peaceful and constructive use of dialectic and dialogue in science and historical scholarship and in philosophy. But he says there are differing Christian communions, and each one of them may be represented by more than one theology. But still, the ecumenical movement and the dialogue of religions powerfully foster acceptance of an ironic and constructive use of dialectic. John Paul II was after that, I think, when he called the meetings in Assisi. That was his instinct. He wasn't informed by Lonergan, I don't think at all, but his instinct was that the atmosphere was ripe for a peaceful and constructive dialogue. And so he promoted that. So the lecture has distinguished different methods: experimental methods, foundational methods, historical, dialectical, critically practical. The conclusions are three. Number one, the more religious studies and theology put to good use the whole battery of methods, the more they will move asymptotically towards an ideal situation in which they overlap and become easily interchangeable. Now this is way down the line. This is not going to happen tomorrow. Try to get the School of Religion and the Toronto School of Theology together, and you'll find that we're still far from this ideal situation. Such overlapping and interchangeability are desirable. Theology and religious studies need each other. And praxis, the praxis element of these disciplines, will include a recognition of the obstacles that stand in the way and an effort to remove them. And there are as many possible obstacles as there are plausible grounds for rejecting or hesitating about any of the different methods. If the methods really are sound, then the obstacles may be removed by applying both the hermeneutic of suspicion and the hermeneutic of recovery vis-a-vis the methods and their applications. Okay, so it's an extraordinarily sophisticated piece of writing here, but I've tried to unpack as much of it as I could in a brief compass. And you see the vision, but it's a long, long-range vision. So can we take a few questions, and then we can take a little break? If there are any questions, don't force them.
I was reading recently Derrida's and the margins of philosophy and the notion of difference there. And then, this is also related to a class that I recently had, and then the presentation was basically from a postmodern perspective in the end of the day, I think it left the class all dissipated and confused, in the sense that, you know, there are no foundations at all. I'm just wondering how Lonergan would respond to Derrida's concern, I think. It seems like the proliferation of methods on the one hand, and then also the discovery of historical consciousness and the radicalizing of hermeneutics.
Mm-hmm.
One way to appropriate that, which to me seems to be the most integrative or holistic, is if you take Lonergan's position on the human interiority and its cognition analysis. Another way, I think, is to go with that is to take what Derrida is doing and say, well, it's just, you kind of absolutize proliferation and say it's just, you know, you can't, there's no foundation at the end of the day to kind of integrate a whole lot of them together. My own sense is that I think if you take someone like Heidegger, he recognizes, if you take the basic structure of human knowing, subject, object, and how that is kind of a recognition that there is a mediation between the two, in whatever way you want to call it, and how you want to identify the locus of that mediation, he kind of, I think, holds all three of them together and says that they are equiprimordial.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for me, postmodernity emerges, it's a positive insight that that there are contexts that mediate our experience of data and our reception of data and so on, that there are differences and you have to take that into account. The problem I find with postmodernity is that it when some thinkers absolutize that and make that as the ground, something Heidegger does not do. And I think Derrida kind of does that, building on Heidegger. So I'm wondering what Lonergan's response would be to someone like Derrida. Because I think he emphasizes the basic position that Heidegger has, equiprimordial. Plus, I think he gives you that operative framework that is able to hold together both the insights of modernity and post-modernity.
Lonergan.
In a way that's more, I would say, Heidegger indicates that, but I think Lonergan kind of differentiates what actually takes place and, you know, makes it a bit more concrete.
I think Lonergan's able to appropriate a lot of Heidegger into his structure. I mean, I think that the structure is able to appropriate a lot of it. I think it's the radical choice. I think you put it quite well at the beginning of what you were saying there, because in both cases there is the acknowledgement of the proliferation and of multiplicity and of pluralisms. The issue is that for Lonergan there is this generalized empirical method that will enable the community, not just the individual, but the community to see its way through all of that and to live with the proliferation. But still to have the foundation, to have a foundation, and to be, in that sense, beyond relativism. The person, I think, today who might be, I'm not sure about this, but, you know, John Caputo for years was very negative about both Lonergan and Habermas, thinking that they were rationalists. And he's a Catholic. Caputo is a Catholic who has been influenced very strongly by Derrida and finds a lot of negative theology in Derrida, negative theology in the sense of the mystical negation but he has written the introduction to a new book on the something of the other. And it's all on Lonergan and postmodernism. And Caputo pretty much said that the essays opened his own eyes to the significance of Lonergan with respect to the issues that are being raised in postmodern literature. I was really surprised to see this, because I know he's been in dialogue with Jim Marsh at Fordham, and Marsh, they're very good friends, but they fight like cats and dogs when they get together. And And Marsh is very, knows the postmodern literature, but he's also very big on Lonergan, and you know, so they're back and forth. Caputo's calling Marsh a rationalist. I'm a rationalist. I'm more of a Marxist than a rationalist. Like you can, and then he's going back at Caputo, calling him a nihilist and a relativist. And they're both Catholic, and they're both Catholic. Anyway, there's a meeting of the minds now with this, you know. And it was the essays written for the book. Caputo, they asked him, would you read these? And if you feel disposed, would you write the foreword to the book? And it was a very positive foreword. And he said, if this is what Lonergan's all about, he's very important for this whole movement. Mm-hmm. So, okay, let's break for a few